have that available in the archives afterwards. And I want to just say welcome to everyone. This is Tom Anderson, and you have joined the June edition of the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace teleconference series from the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace at the University of Arkansas. Every month, we are having conversations with leaders from the worlds of academia, business worlds, writers, all centered around the general idea of asking questions about what business leaders can learn from the faith and spiritual traditions in order to do a better job in service to all stakeholders. Our guest today is Michael Strong, and I will say more about Michael in a moment, but in the meantime, welcome, Michael. Really good to have you here with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's wonderful to be here.
We traditionally start these calls with a reading, followed by just a moment or two in shared silence, and we'll start today's call the same way. And I'm going to be reading from Michael's book that we'll be talking about, spending most of our time on this hour. The name of the book is Be the Solution, How Entrepreneurs and Conscious Capitalists Can Solve All the World's Problems. And it's the opening paragraph from the first chapter. And this is what it says. Among the first teachings of the Buddha is the understanding that, quote, mind is the forerunner of all things, end quote. If we believe it is impossible to make the world a better place, we will create a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we believe we can make a difference, and set about doing so with a clear-eyed vision, passionate focus, persistence, and courage, then we can achieve extraordinary things. So with that inspirational idea in mind, why don't we just take a minute of shared silence, where I just invite you to turn to source as however you conceive or define source in a moment of shared silence. Thank you. And so I'd like to share some things with our audience about our guest today. Michael Strong is the CEO and Chief Visionary Officer of Flow Incorporated, which he co-founded with John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods Market. Michael is the lead author of Be the Solution, How Entrepreneurs and Conscious Capitalists Can Solve All the World's Problems. The book was co-authored with John Mackey, Muhammad Yunus, who's the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Fernando de Soto, co-chair of the UN Commission on the Legal Empowerment of the Poor, and several others. Michael's work is featured in academic journals, such as the Journal of Business Ethics, Economic Affairs, also in specialty publications like Microfinance, Insights, Policy Innovations, etc., and in media reaching popular audiences like the New York Times, Bloomberg, the Huffington Post, and others. He serves on several boards, and he is a mentor for developing world entrepreneurs for the MIT Legatum Center for Entrepreneurship and Development. Prior to his work on conscious capitalism, Michael spent 15 years as an educational entrepreneur, which is a concept he spends some time talking about in the book, creating several high-performance private and charter schools, including one that was named the 36th best public school in the U.S. on the Washington Post Challenge Index. He's the author of The Habit of Thought, From Socratic Seminars to Socratic Practice, and he has consulted for hundreds of schools around the world. Michael himself received his education at Harvard, St. John's College, and the University of Chicago. So Michael, welcome to our teleconference.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for the gracious introduction.
My pleasure. You know, I just want to start by saying that I really like the title of your book, but I'm going to scold you a bit in the subtitle, How Entrepreneurs and Conscious Capitalists Can Solve All the World's Problems, for being just a little less ambitious than you might have been. Just all the world's problems, Michael? Come on.
Well, I actually went back and forth with my publisher, and I was thinking of pulling punches, and she said, no, you know, let's go for it, let's be bold. And actually, what it turns out is when one makes a bold statement like that, I found that I was forced to think ever more imaginatively about the ways in which, you know, entrepreneurship and conscious capitalism can solve problems. And I think if we set only modest goals, we will have only modest achievements. If one sets very bold and ambitious goals, that's the only possibility of getting there. As Wayne Gretzky liked to say, you miss every shot you don't take.
Let's take them. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, I love that, and I love the premise that it laid out right from the start. It gave me as a reader a good idea of where you were going. And you know, there's always the opportunity in the follow-up book to start working on, you know, solving all the problems of the galaxy or the universe or something. And so that work is ahead of you, I'm sure.
Thank you, Tom. I'll co-author it with you.
So let me just paint a little bit of a broad context to how I see our conversation today kind of fitting into the series of conversations that we've been having here with this group over the past few months. If you go back 4 months ago, we interviewed Raj Sisodia, who you probably know. He was a co-author of the book Firms of Endearment, very involved with the Conscious Capitalism Institute as one of the leaders there. We talked a lot about his multi-stakeholder model and his studies showing how that approach and an approach in a business organization focused on higher purpose can also translate into much higher profits in a successful organization. We followed that up with a conversation with Tammy Simon, who is the founder and owner of Sounds True, a company she founded about 26 years ago based on a multiple bottom line approach of focusing on people, purpose, and profits, as opposed to just strictly a more typical structure of just looking at profits as the indicator of success. The following month, we had a conversation with Patricia Aberdeen, who back in the mid-2000s wrote Megatrends 2010, The Rise of Conscious Capitalism. And we kind of look back at that book and the things that she has observed that have come to pass since in those days in the past several years. And so we've been talking about this concept of conscious capitalism. But we have primarily been talking about it from the context of the interior of organizations, in how leaders of organizations deal with their stakeholders, which includes both in kind of internal and external stakeholders. And what I liked about your book as I was going through it, and what really inspired me to contact you and ask you to participate in this series, is that you propose what I see here to be a broader context, almost a macroeconomic kind of approach to this conversation about conscious capitalism. And so I want to kind of probe into that. I'd like to maybe ask you to start by talking about the work of Flow Incorporated, how it came to be, how you and John Mackey came together to form that organization, some of what it's up to, and then from there kind of dive into how the book came to be as a piece of that work you're doing at Flow. Does all that make some sense?
That makes wonderful sense, Tom, and that's a mouthful, but I'll get started.
Okay.
First, I'm delighted to hear about the previous guests. They're all part of our network. Raj is on the same conscious capitalism board that I'm on. Tammy Simon has spoken for us on a number of occasions and often attends our events, and Patricia Aberdeen has been involved and spoken at our conferences as well. So it's a great lineup, and I would say that I would differentiate, increasingly, as we've seen this sort of difference between my kind of macro perspective, as you call it, and the more firm-level perspective. John and I and others are increasingly talking about conscious business as the firm-level focus. It is important to focus on how a specific business firm can engage with a more conscious perspective. And then conscious capitalism would then refer to kind of a systemic perspective, or how we can think about the larger system. Mm-hmm. And then to kind of go into how we got here, 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago now, I met John Mackey through a mutual friend, Gary Hoover. Gary Hoover was an Austin area entrepreneur who created Bookstop, which was then bought by Barnes & Noble in the 1990s. And in essence, Gary really started the whole big box bookstore trend. And his first Bookstop was next to John's second Whole Foods. So they were Austin entrepreneurs from way back. And Gary and I both shared a love of Chicago economics and education. And I was having lunch with him, and I said, you know, I'd love to create the Whole Foods of education. And he said, well, I would prefer to create the Target of education, but I know this guy. So he introduced me to John. And John and I had lunch, and we quickly discovered that we shared a real passion for idealism, doing good, purpose, meaning, spirituality, positivity, and really making a difference in the world. And we really believe entrepreneurs and markets were the best way to do that. And we found that usually when we were rah-rah entrepreneurs and markets, a lot of the people in that world were not so sympathetic to our doing good side and our purpose, meaning, and spirituality side. And conversely, when we were among the do-gooders, sometimes they were not entirely as enthusiastic about entrepreneurs and markets as we were. So we kind of jokingly say that we wanted to create a club where we could belong and find other people who enjoyed would join it with us. And since then, we found a large number of people are deeply, profoundly interested in this integration of business and making the world a better place. And we're delighted to be part of that movement. Flow has three kind of specific programs that developed. One is Accelerating Women Entrepreneurs, which promotes women's entrepreneurship in the developing world beyond microfinance. Our vision is to have a world in which there are women running $20 million businesses, $50 million businesses, and so forth in Afghanistan and Senegal and Peru and around the world. Another is Peace Through Commerce, where we look at all the ways in which commerce and business can create peace, reduce conflict, or help post-conflict areas become prosperous and stable. And then third is Conscious Capitalism, which has become by far the largest, and that's the, in some ways, a club and a network of entrepreneurs and business leaders who are passionate about using their companies to do good in diverse ways. The book, Be the Solution, came about because in the course of kind of developing these programs and exploring these ideas, I'm really an idea person, you know, we were meeting all of these amazing people doing all of these amazing things and also looking fairly seriously at the ways in which the structure of capitalism helped determine if it was positive or negative in its outcome. And we wanted to kind of gather all of this material together in one place. And so the result is Be the Solution. So that's kind of a quick version.
So as you look at this idea of structures, of conscious capitalism as a structure, one of the things that jumped out at me, and it's kind of an underlying theme, and there was some specific discussion about it in the book as well, is the idea that we don't have good overall structures to talk about conscious capitalist businesses or social entrepreneurial businesses like we do, you know, just more typical for-profit entities. We don't have a stock exchange. We don't have ways of bond rating agencies that specialize in these sorts of things. And we don't really have an economic theory system that seems to be suited to the kinds of things we're talking about today. What are the challenges we face there, and what are some of the ways that you talk about in the book of kind of meeting those challenges and broadening this conversation, the way we see things like this?
Oh, great question. Well, a couple of things. First, a lot of times people are eager for us to come up with a specific metric of performance of conscious capitalist companies. And while we might at some point, for the time being, I'm enthusiastic about the fact that we're seeing a proliferation of such metrics. And rather than say necessarily that there's one right one, I like the fact that more and more people care about meaning and purpose with respect to their consumption decisions, investment decisions, employment decisions, and so forth. And the fact is different people have different concerns. Some people really want to care most about women and whether or not it's helping women. Others, Africa, sometimes sustainability issues, sometimes even more specific. And that's okay. Rather than say there's one right or wrong answer, I like the idea of a proliferation of metrics. And often when I've seen anybody become too attached to one metric, I see sort of limitations where there's a great company that doesn't quite fit that metric. And am I going to say that company's not great? No, I can see the good they're doing. So I think it's appropriate to have a diverse world where there's a broad conversation about how to do good in business in diverse ways. Second thing I'd like to say about this general issue is that We found that most entrepreneurs start their companies with a deep sense of purpose and commitment, and growth is really the challenge. Often, you know, when they are getting funding from friends and families, you know, still it's aligned. Venture capital can be a little bit, you know, angel investors, sometimes it can still be aligned funding. Sometimes venture capital is not always as aligned, and so there, it can be tricky. And then finally, when they go public, it can be tricky to maintain integrity of mission when they go public. And so a lot of what people in our network are working on is starting from the original entrepreneur's deep sense of purpose. How does one maintain integrity of purpose as one grows? And it's not just capital, although capital can influence integrity of purpose, but it's also rapid growth makes it hard to control quality. Or, you know, if one makes certain claims when one is small, how does one continue to make those claims with integrity if one grows? So we've got a diverse set of, I would say, service providers and experts and so forth that are working on that issue of how to maintain integrity while one grows. Then finally, I am interested in structural issues such as how to internalize externalities. You know, I'm very interested in, say, a green tax shift where, which, by the way, can be transpartisan. That is, in green tax shift, one takes taxes away from taxing income, wages, and capital gains and so forth, and instead taxes various aspects of harm to the environment. What's nice about that is that people on the left often like the fact that the, certainly environmentalists like the fact that one is taxing harms to the environment, and yet traditional business constituencies like the fact that you're not taxing capital gains and salaries and so forth, because that makes it more valuable to employ people. It makes it easier to employ people, and it encourages investment by rewarding gains. So we're interested in the structural moves like that that we believe will help entrepreneurs solve more of my problems by increasing alignment, you know, entrepreneurial activity and doing good at a systemic level.
Mm-hmm. You started to touch into something there with that response that I want to lean into a little bit deeper, because it's a central theme of your book. And it's this idea that oftentimes when we start talking about structural ideas and concepts, it often leads us down the path to a conversation that tends to formulate around kind of a left-right dichotomy or duality of thinking. And you're very clear in your book that, I mean, at times it's almost as if with tongue-in-cheek you're attempting to upset both the left and the right simultaneously thereby through the creation of a third way of approaching these problems. And you're really clear about this, and I really like that about the book. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Thank you very much, Tom, for that question. It's one of the more perceptive questions I've come across. One of the reviewers did say that the book is in some ways the perfect transpartisan book and will make hardcore partisans on both sides sick.
Yeah.
And part of it is, and this is actually one of the great things about having community, I think one of the things that I'll be forever grateful to John Mackey for is he and I began to have a community where we had an uncompromising commitment to entrepreneurial capitalism and an uncompromising commitment to doing the right thing. And what that does, even when one has one other person, is then one starts to see the world differently. And so we have really no patience for people who don't understand and see the real good that capitalism has done in history. One of the things that I often say in my talks, I speak on college campuses a lot, is in 1800, almost everyone on Earth was poorer than are the poorest Africans today. And now, you know, a billion, going on 2 billion people have remarkably comfortable lives, and more are on the way, and we urgently need to help everybody. But it's just a miracle. It's a miracle that we ought to be grateful for every single day. At the same time, it is in fact true that many entrepreneurs and capitalists also, many businesses also, you know, do harmful things. That's inexcusable. And so on the one hand, one should not be excusing, you know, pollution or ignoring human rights or various harmful things that certain companies have done and continue to do. So one can be absolutely committed to the notion that we should each and every day do the right thing in our professional lives, in our consumer lives as consumers, as investors, and so forth, and say, even though some companies do the wrong thing, that capitalism as a whole has been extraordinarily positive for And entrepreneurial capitalism, done right in a conscious capitalist manner, is the most powerful force going forward. And we welcome people into this community to engage with us in this dialogue and kind of help escape, I would say, the 20th century. At one point, I was at a dinner party where we were talking about these ideas, and there was an older couple and on the right and left, and they were arguing, and the daughters from the younger generation said to their parents, "That's so 20th century. You know, I think there's a younger generation that's completely gets that capitalism can be a force for good, and many young people really want to be entrepreneurs, and they want to do it right." So I'm very optimistic about kind of transcending some of the old fights in the past, even though if you look at the news, they're more vicious than ever.
Yeah. There's a couple of lines from your book I want to quote to kind of maybe push into this a little bit further, because I felt like these were controversial enough that they might set some hackles on end, but I think they're big ideas that really made me anyway just sit and think about it a little bit, and they're both from the chapter on improving health, happiness, and well-being. The first one comes from page 228. And it says this, this is your writing. It says, "Here I will propose that the reason that capitalism has resulted in such crass consumerism and materialism is, paradoxically, because we do not have enough of it yet." And then the follow-up quote on page 265, "I continue to be committed to the liberation of the spirit, and I have gradually come to realize that as I liberate spirits, I have an absolute obligation to simultaneously provide training and self-control." How do those two things kind of play off with one another? Those two ideas that we need to unleash the entrepreneurial spirit to a greater level. We don't have enough capitalism. And that's why we have issues that we have, and consumerism and other things you mentioned. And at the same time, as we release this entrepreneurial spirit, or spirit of however you want to describe it, it comes with a dual, greater level of responsibility of self-monitoring, self-control.
Again, you're a remarkably perceptive reader. These are good issues to dig into. The first quotation about not enough capitalism profoundly comes from my experience as an educator. And really, I would say the meaninglessness of K-12 education as it exists really around the world. I've consulted for school systems around the world as well as in the U.S. extensively. I think purpose and meaning is necessary and essential for the human spirit. And it's especially necessary and essential, if it's possible to say especially essential, for young people. And yet, when one goes into most schools around the world, and especially adolescents, I spent most of my time working on secondary schools, most teenagers are not living a vibrant sense of purpose. And I really think that adolescence in the modern world is a catastrophic disaster. And I think the pathologies of consumerism, materialism, casual sex, drugs, violence, gangs, you name it, are all symptoms of the fact that young people, most of the time, not all, there are young people that have their own sense of purpose, young people whose families give them a sense of purpose, whose churches give them a sense of purpose, who do have, there's teachers in school that do provide a sense of purpose. So I don't mean 100%. But to a really terrifying extent, there are a lot of young people that don't have this deep sense of, purpose on a daily basis. And so as a consequence, they become these consumers where they want to get something from outside. Their souls are starved, and so they want to get something. And then they go in all sorts of directions that are non-optimal. And, companies want young consumers. They try to get young people addicted to their brands and addicted to certain habits in their life. I'm working on an education program now, right now, called Bronze Doors Academy, and you'll recognize bronze doors from Ghiberti, the Italian Renaissance artist who created one pair of bronze doors on a cathedral. It took him 21 years to do so, and then he created another pair of bronze doors, and it took him another 24 years to do so. So basically, his entire life's work consisted of two bronze doors, but those are incredible bronze doors that will be known forever. And I think it's really important for all of us to have a lifelong sense of purpose. The Greeks like to say, judge no man happy until he's died. And I think in order for us to really live beyond just for the moment, we need to have a sense of lifelong purpose. So, for me, the you know, it's essential to create a healthy capitalist system, and it's essential to create a healthy society that we create schools where meaning and purpose comes first and foremost. And, you know, the book goes into that, so I won't go into that more at present. At the same time, you know, the second sentence you read comes from my experience specifically as a Socratic educator, where often I took families, you know, I took students who would sometimes come from traditional households and had not, you know, asked questions. Socrates was put to death for getting young people of Athens to ask questions. And I found that I was causing some discomfort in traditional meaning systems, and I realized that it was in fact a dangerous thing. And as a Socratic intellectual, I had been far too cavalier about the impact of, you know, getting people to think for themselves. Intellectuals around the world celebrate getting us to think for themselves, but if one doesn't have a really strong sense of meaning and purpose, once you take away a traditional meaning system, kids sometimes go into a chaotic place. And so I've become very interested in the notion of virtue cultures. I think the best schools are virtue culture, the best companies are best virtue culture. Try as I will, I'm not a perfect being, but somebody once said we're an average of the five people we hang out with the most. And so if I can find five people that help make me a better person, I become a better person. But if I hang out with the wrong five people, no, I'm just not as good. And so I think we need to be very conscious and deliberate about creating virtue cultures in our workplaces, in our schools. It's great to have them at churches and in spiritual places, but I think that it cannot be just part of the time. We need people who help make us our best selves all the time. So in order to use capitalism responsibly, in order to use Socratic intellectuality responsibly, in order to use consumer goods responsibly, you know, in order to take advantage of freedom, and I'm a passionate believer in freedom, we also need people around us who help to temper our worst short-term instincts and help us become the best lifelong human beings that we can possibly be. Mm-hmm. That helps?
Yeah, it really does. Since you mentioned the schools, one of the things that I really enjoyed was the section in the book where you were talking about what would our world look like if we reversed the ways we thought about housing and education. Can you speak into that just a little bit? There's a lot in there, but just hit the highlights and give people a taste of what you were shooting for there, and it'll intrigue some, I noticed, to pick this book up and read it for themselves.
Sure. Well, of course, what's interesting too about that is the book was written, it was finished kind of in the fall of 2008, just as the housing crisis was really becoming apparent. So I have a tiny bit about the housing crisis, but most of the book was written prior to that, and certainly that section was. But for some time, you know, I've been aware of the fact that the notion of one's own home is considered, you know, almost sacred. And in British common law in the late 19th century, there is the notion that man's home is his castle. And so we have this sense that we should not only allow people to have their homes and the privacy of their homes and decide what their homes are like, but we should have government subsidize that a great deal. And so we've got this incredible system of mortgage tax credits, as well as all sorts of other inducements to encourage people to have homes, and then remarkable freedom in what they do with those homes. At the same time, there's been a kind of, in the 60s and 70s, there was an attempt at government housing, often which ended up in a dreadful situation where you would concentrate people with some of the least healthy virtue cultures in, you know, these horrible buildings. I remember I was in Chicago when Cabrini Green was basically seeing a child shot almost every week, and it was just horrifying. And finally, I believe they you know, bombed Cabrini Green or burned it, blew it up or whatever, and gave the former residents housing credits so that they could go and rent apartments elsewhere rather than, and hopefully, I think, not be in a concentrated place where people with weak virtue cultures are stuck in one place together. You know, and so this notion that, you know, obviously our own house is an important thing, and obviously government-created and managed housing failed, and yet with respect to schooling, the norm is government schooling, and people who, as it were, homeschool or create their own little schools are often considered marginalized and strange. And, you know, we expect most kids to go to government schools. I went to public schools growing up, and I although I did very well, went to Harvard and everything, I regard those years as the most boring and cruel years of my life. The only time I'm that bored is when I'm, you know, the dentist's office or Department of Motor Vehicles as an adult. And, you know, I've created schools where kids are alive, happy, vibrant, learning incredible amounts. And again, I think that we've allowed ourselves to get in a situation where it's normal to go to government schools, but not normal to create our own custom education for our children. And I think we'd actually be better off living in government housing, but having our own private schools and private educational systems that met the urgent, deep meaning and purpose need for young people. And I think that we'd have a much healthier, more positive society with social dysfunction.
Well, we're talking today with Michael Strong. He is the co-founder and visionary leader of Flow Incorporated, and he's the author of Be the Solution, How Entrepreneurs and Conscious Capitalists Can Solve All the World's Problems. We're coming to that point in our program, in our hour. We're going to open up the phone lines and allow folks that are on the call today to ask Michael their questions. As you can tell with the little bit that we've covered so far, this is a far-ranging book. There are more than enough ideas to sit and ponder. You could take one page out of this book and sit and ponder it for a year, I think. There's just so many great ideas in the book. And so if something we've been talking about so far has piqued your interest, I invite you to electronically raise your hand by hitting *5 on your phone. That will raise your hand on the screen I'm looking at here and will allow me to unmute you so I can call on you and you can ask your question of Michael. While you're thinking about your question, I want to make just a few quick announcements. First, coming up in November, the 7th through the 9th, the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace will be sponsoring the International Conference on Faith and Spirit at Work. It will be held in Fayetteville, Arkansas at the University of Arkansas. Again, that's November 7th through 9th. And there's a deadline coming up the end of this month. June 30th is a deadline for two things in regards to that conference. For the application for the International Faith and Spirit at Work Awards, as well as for the International Faith and Spirit at Work Individual Leadership Award. You can find more information about those awards. You can find more information about the conference itself on the website, which is tfsw.uark.edu. Also want to let you know that next month, on July 20th, our guest in this teleconference series will be Cindy Wigglesworth, who is a consultant, the owner of a company called Deep Change, and the developer of a concept called spiritual intelligence, which she has tested and is using in organizations all around the country and internationally now, I believe, to as a measurement tool and a tool for helping to lead deep change in organizations. I've spoken with Cindy many times in the past. A lot of you know her, and she's a fascinating lady, and I'm just really looking forward to that conference call as well. That's coming up on July 20th. I would also invite everyone to connect with us on a deeper level. We've got a Facebook page, of course. You know, I think it's against the law not to have a Facebook page these days, so you can find us on Facebook. And you can also join in the conversation on our LinkedIn page, where there's just constantly all kinds of ideas being discussed and bannered about. I'd like to invite you to join that conversation if you're not a member of our LinkedIn group. Now, I have said something, that the way you raise your hand is by hitting *5, and I am thinking that I'm having more technical difficulties today. Let me check that. Yeah, I think that's correct. If you'll hit *5 on your keypad, then you can raise your hand and ask your question of Michael. So while we're doing that, one of the things that struck me, and it's not uncommon to see it today, but the emphasis with your organization on women as entrepreneurs. Why do you see that from your perspective as an important piece of work? I mean, it almost goes without saying that it's important, but I'd like to hear your perspective on that. Why is that a central focus of your work?
Well, thank you. You know, there are a couple of different things. One is, we use entrepreneurship broadly, including respect for entrepreneurs. I think that I see entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs as people who take initiative to make a difference. And I think a lot of the most dynamic companies will want to have a lot of entrepreneurs in terms of dynamic, creative, innovative people within the organization. So to some extent, we see the ability to be creative, a creative value creator, to be applicable and valuable across all walks of life. Beyond that, especially in the developing world, we think that one of the most effective ways to address there's a change in traditional gender roles around the world, and it's sometimes difficult in some societies which have traditional gender roles. My wife and I speak in Saudi Arabia each year, and of course that society is well known for not having the most up-to-date gender roles, so to speak. But in all of these situations, we think that legislation is not the best way to force changes in perspective, really on any social change. And it's better if social change happens organically and naturally. And so we like the thought, and where we've seen it, the example of women who have created significant companies that add value to the world in sometimes distinctive ways that women can do so. And the fact that women have done that adds a sense of possibility to other women. They say, wow, you know, I could create a real company that's really successful. It changes the way men relate to women. It's one thing to have a woman scholar or a woman politician. The fact is, people do respect successful business people. So as we have more successful business women who are actually the entrepreneurs that created the companies, we believe that will change gender roles in a fairly fundamental way around the world. And finally, we do think that, as Muhammad Yunus suggests, not always, but on balance, women are somewhat more likely to use their wealth and their companies to have a positive impact on women and children. Whereas, as Yunus says, to some extent, sometimes men, in especially some circumstances, can spend wealth on things that are perhaps not as valuable to the well-being of children. And just as an aside, my wife is a Senegalese entrepreneur whom I met and married through our Accelerating Women Entrepreneurs program. Mm. I always joke that I found the best one and married her. So I'm very, very deeply related to and actively involved in women's entrepreneurship in Senegal via helping my wife create her second company.
Well, it's certainly important work. And I think you're right that there is a different kind of perspective that women bring to some of these conversations. I often wonder about, as in this country and in Western countries and society, as women have become bigger players, more actively involved in our business organizations, rising in the ranks of management over the past 20 years or so. I think that has been a catalyst for a lot of the changes that we've been talking about today. They, along with them, they have brought a different perspective than maybe the typical male perspective has been over the years, and they've opened their eyes, and they've allowed us to see things in a different way. So I just applaud you for continuing to help foster that kind of growth.
Well, thank you. And just at the simplest and most pragmatic level, women being introduced into the workforce and having higher and higher positions has made a certain kind of sexual harassment simply less acceptable. Again, my wife is Senegalese, but she was educated in France. And she and many other French people will say that Strauss-Kahn would never have been, indicted, whether or not he's guilty, in France, simply because it was acceptable behavior there to a horrifying extent. And in the U.S., it's an ongoing struggle, but women in the workplace expect to be treated differently, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And these movements happen slowly, but the U.S. has actually done relatively well compared to the standards of many countries around the world. That's not something that people in the conscious capitalism. I always try to get people to think very broadly about conscious capitalism. Sometimes people want to think just about sustainability. The fact is, there are countless ways to make the world better, and I think we want to think imaginatively, creatively, about the different ways in which capitalism has and can improve things going forward.
When you talk about ways to make the world better, one of the themes of the book is this idea of property rights, and expanding and opening up property rights on a greater level in more and more places. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, about what role you see that playing in the expansion of entrepreneurism and conscious capitalism?
Sure, thank you. I mean, Hernando de Soto, who contributed a chapter in the book, is a great pioneer in this. And if anybody's not read de Soto's book, The Mystery of Capital, Why Capitalism Succeeds in the West and Fails Everywhere Else, I think it's pretty much should be required reading for everyone. You know, de Soto is the one who focused on the fact that he was doing research in Peru in the late 80s when the Shining Path was a Maoist guerrilla group that was causing a great deal of violence, looked like they were going to create a revolution in Peru. And de Soto went and actually looked at poor people in Peru and discovered they were incredibly entrepreneurial, that they were busy creating all these little businesses and buying and selling and finding ways to, you know, solve problems in the absence of money and government support and so forth. And what he discovered is that many of them were thwarted by two things. On the one hand, they often didn't have legal title to their land, so they would be squatters and squat on land and build houses. You know, when one thinks of squatters, perhaps in a tent, but sometimes these squatters are around cities in the developing world everywhere have been there for 30, 50 years, 70 years, generations. They have 2-3-story buildings, you know, but they have no property rights. And without property rights, everything is at risk. And one, because one doesn't have legal title to the property, you know, you can't get a loan, you can't get insurance. If somebody comes and destroys it, violence is really your only recourse. And that really limits the extent to which capitalism is possible. In addition, De Soto discovered that most developing nations, really all developing nations, are massively overregulated, and that in order to get a license to operate a small sewing company with 2 sewing machines, I believe it took almost a year of going through a bureaucratic nonsense in Peru. And then he did research on Egypt and other countries, and the ultimate result is the Doing Business Index, now run by the World Bank, where they monitor how hard it is for an indigenous entrepreneur to create a business around the world. And it's remarkable. As I always like to point out, it's easier in Denmark to start a legal business or to fire an employee than it is in any developing nation. So I it's not just property rights, but also property rights and ease of doing business. And I give credit to De Soto for pointing out to us that the world's poor do not have access to the legal capacity to create a legal business.
And there are those that would say there's a real strong argument to be made that that very fact is the root of much of what we have seen come about as what we're calling the, you know, all the events in the Middle East of the past few months. You know, some of them.
Absolutely. The Tunisian man, I don't think the press called attention to this adequately. The Tunisian man who first immolated himself did so after he was a merchant who was harassed by a bureaucrat, and they took away his scales and his means of making a living. And it's typical, again, in the developing world that small merchants are harassed constantly. One of the things about it taking a year to get a license to do business legally is that almost all small business people in the developing world are doing business illegally. And what that means is that the police and regulatory enforcers can shake down anybody at any point in time. In Senegal, my wife has a driver, and he is scrupulous to have his paperwork intact, because otherwise there are police roadblocks, you know, really every few miles sometimes, and the police basically expect a bribe. And often people complain about developing world corruption. They complain about the fact that it's because the officials aren't paid enough sometimes, or there's a culture of corruption. The fact is, if almost everybody is illegal, then everybody has to pay bribes. The driver is careful to keep his paperwork done, and it's elaborate to keep that paperwork done, but he just shows his card and goes through without paying a bribe, because they do respect, you know, legal paperwork. So it's really, I think, an underreported story, the extent to which this massive overregulation is a cause for the immolation of that particular poor man in Tunisia, as well as the economic lassitude of countries throughout the Middle East.
So we have a caller with her hand up, and I've unmuted your line. I don't have your name, but the last 4 digits of your phone number is 9798.
Hi, my name is Ruthanna Tureri. I'm calling, I'm the president and founder of the Hope Water Foundation. Can you hear me?
I can. Did you say Hope Water?
Yes, Hope Water Foundation.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you for having Strawn on. It's been very interesting, actually. I'm an entrepreneur myself. We started Hope 2 years ago, and what we do is we sell consumer products in order to raise money and awareness of the world's water crisis. Our main product is a bottle of water called Hope, the world's kindest water, which just hit the market 8 weeks ago. What the question on kind of the advice I'm seeking today is, we started Hope as a nonprofit. My belief has always been that nonprofits have to learn how to behave like businesses in order to survive in this very noisy world that we live in. And we knew when we went into it that we were going to have to transition into a profit because of the laws pertaining to nonprofits getting earning more than 10% of their income from a sale of a product. So right now we're preparing to transition because, of course, our product has hit the market. And everyone in their
Hello?
Oh, we might have lost her. Michael, I'm not sure exactly where she was going, but what I was thinking about as she was starting the question is that it seems to be a real life example of some of the very same things that you're talking about in the book. The structural challenges that we have to make a choice: are we a nonprofit or are we a for-profit entity? And what happens
exactly
when we choose either? Oh, okay, you're back. Good. So go ahead with your question.
No, exactly what you're talking about. And when we I almost feel like as a founder, I always feel like I'm selling my soul because our whole premise was based on the fact that we're going to give 100% of what we make, you know, net proceeds to our beneficiaries. And now as I have to transfer into a profit and attract investors, I have to give that up and find a percentage of our sales that will do the most work that we can do and still satisfy the investor. So I guess advice would be for us right now is how to internally come to terms with that, and then structurally how much is enough if it's not 100%.
Well, those are a lot of good questions. First, I want to back up a bit and say that over the years, because of what we do as an organization, we've had hundreds of people basically ask us if they should go nonprofit or for profit. And pretty much we say always go for profit unless you have a specific donor or donors who need the tax deduction for nonprofit. Part of that is, some people think that if it's for profit, it has to be about money. That's not the case at all, and I'll explain more about that in a minute. But for profits are just much more flexible, whereas nonprofits, there are a lot of restrictions. And if you haven't yet had him as a guest, Tom, I highly recommend Dan Pallotta, the author of Uncharitable. Mm-hmm. And his book is all about how the limitations of a nonprofit structure reduce the extent to which nonprofits can really do good. And he's just brilliant and well-informed on this. That's Dan Pallotta, Uncharitable. But then to go to your specific question, because there is a lot, this is a very active field in terms of different people doing different things, there are specific corporate structures. I know a lawyer in California who specializes in creating corporate founding documents that specify a certain commitment to mission in an effort to ensure that even as a company grows and accepts venture capital and becomes very large, that the founding documents make sure that it can't deviate from that mission. And he doesn't have, he's only been doing this for a few years. It's not as if he's got companies that are now worth hundreds of millions or billions of dollars modeling this yet. But he's very, very passionate about this. And kind of one example of somebody who's specifically writing legal structures in an attempt to make sure that companies can allocate funds as they will. There's, of course, the for-benefit corporation. There's a whole movement based on a for-benefit structure. It's called a B Corporation, and you can go to the B Corporation website and learn all about exactly what they expect. They're restrictive in their own way, but if their restrictions fit your situation, you could become a for-benefit corporation. And some states actually have legislation that is designed to support B Corporations. That said, I know the General Counsel of Whole Foods, and she argues and will argue in public that, in fact, a company doesn't need any necessary legal structure to ensure a commitment to purpose and meaning. They're a public, Whole Foods is a public company that is obliged to their shareholders, but they make the case that their mission is really important to their value proposition as a company. And so the Whole Foods management will defend, and they have dozens of innovative programs for doing good, many of which people are not familiar with, but because the culture of the company is so committed to their business model, they make a strong case against shareholders, even if quarterly earnings are down, that it would be absolutely catastrophic to their business model to change things. And finally, that's for a public company. For a private company, you know, you can do what you want, pretty much. You don't have to, you know, you can, if you wanted, you could make money for yourself and donate it to a nonprofit. You could allocate as much, a higher percentage as you please of your profits directly to any cause. You could reinvest, as it were, the profits of your company into water projects in the developing world. You know, it's really a matter of getting your investors in alignment with what your intentions are. And in general, as long as you don't mislead any investors, as long as you make some commitment as to how you're going to run your business, and everybody investing knows exactly what that is, then you should be fine. And offline, I know attorneys who specialize in this kind of thing, and I can help you identify attorneys that do that. But obviously, I'm not an attorney and can't provide legal advice. But I know that there are a lot of companies that are for-profit, proprietary, and no problem, basically giving all their money away.
Is there anyone? Thank you very much for that. And I will take advantage of your offer to get those names after the show. Is there anyone who's working on valuing the social mission of an organization, as far as, because money has value, goods have value, but there's no sense of, we can look at examples of like how Whole Foods has been successful and say it's because they have a mission and it becomes part of who they are and the value that they value that they have grown in themselves. But there's really no way of, you just have to, I guess maybe the answer is just, you have to speak to the choir. You have to find the people who believe what you believe in and go that route.
You're right. It's all a matter of finding aligned people. I would say two different things. There are, again, many different, Jed Emerson has metrics for measuring blended value. That's his approach. B Corporation has metrics for what they do. There are lots of different people who try to measure triple bottom line according to various metrics. That's not the same as kind of valuing the company, which sounds like what you're talking about. I would say in terms of actually valuing the assets of the company in a for-profit sense, it's interesting, the companies have a lot of brand equity in the absence of significant marketing expenditures. Whole Foods spends almost nothing on marketing, almost no advertising budget, and yet they have tremendous brand equity. And there are rankings of the companies with most brand equity in the world, and Whole Foods is among the highest, most highly ranked. You know, some companies, you know, McDonald's has a lot of brand equity, but they spend, you know, I don't know how many, probably billions on marketing. And, you know, but if a company like Whole Foods has tremendous brand equity, it's out spending much on marketing, then maybe it's because of their positioning as a conscious capitalist company.
I hear that.
Let me jump in. We're starting to run short on time, and just and then just direct you to also maybe check out Raj Sisodia's book, Firms of Endearment. There's a recording of the interview with him on the Tyson Center website. You can listen to it if you missed it. But Raj's work is a lot about the idea of looking at how some of these values are being imputed in terms of stock price return to shareholder, shareholder returns over holding periods and that sort of thing. Really about public companies more so than private, but I think it's at least a start in that direction that you're kind of pushing into. So as we wrap up, Michael, first, your website address. Would you please just let us know where people can find out more information about what you're doing?
Sure. I'll give both flowidealism.org and consciouscapitalism.org. So flowidealism is flowidealism.org. And then consciouscapitalism, conscious, C-O-N-S-C-I-O-U-S, capitalism, all consciouscapitalism, one word, .org. And you can sign up for newsletters, and we'd love to have you follow us.
So before I have a little final reading from the book, any final thoughts today?
I just want to, again, appreciate the fact that you are providing a sustained platform for these ideas through all the guests you've had, and that with respect to me in particular, I think you've identified some of the most important elements in the book, and I look forward to a larger conversation with everybody in the audience. Feel free to email me and get in touch with me. We're passionate about these ideas and want to have all of you help us change the world.
Great. Thanks a lot. So a final reading from the book as we close. And before I do, I just want to thank everyone for participating today. And for thanks to Judy Neal, the executive director of the Tyson Center, for supporting this program. The final reading comes from page 327. And it says this. One often encounters criticisms of contemporary society that accuse our culture of caring too much about money, materialistic goods, appearance, power, or various other shallow appetites. Sometimes these critics then express anger with capitalist society. But there is no need to be angry with anyone. We can begin today to create a world in which people are primarily focused on love, compassion, community, wisdom, beauty, and any other ideals. By our moment-to-moment decisions and interactions, we can begin to create the world we want right now. And so with those hopeful and inspirational words, I just thank everyone once again and wish you all a great day. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thanks to the audience. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.